The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, I saw a stingray out. You might want to take a look at that.
Welcome to Gold, Diamonds, and Death, a James Bond podcast. I'm your 00 host, Jonathan Watkins. I'm a writer for all things under the CinemaSins brand name and a co-host of the Behind the Sins podcast. Joining me each and every week for this endeavor, he's the co-founder of CinemaSins and co-host of the weekly podcast, Recotopia. And if you want his soul, you're just going to have to make a deal with a priest.
Yes.
And he's also one of my good friends, Mr. Chris Atkinson. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
How's it going?
I for some reason that line just sticks with me. I like that line of dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
That was, of course, well, this is what we're going to be talking about this week. Welcome all. We're going to be talking about the movie Quantum of Solace, which is Daniel Craig's second foray into the Bond franchise. Maybe our first, like, just full on direct sequel, maybe.
This is the first time this has to be this direct,
definitely. Mm-hmm. There's been characters, obviously, like, you know, Robbie Coltrane comes back and the Bond ones, and
the end of the story continues to the next one. Yes.
Yeah, nothing like that. Just like, you know, just characters and stuff, but nothing like that. So, Quantum of Solace. So we're going to be talking about also the I believe the shortest Bond film,
mm-hmm.
As far as runtime goes. There actually are reasons for that, which I found out. So let's just dig into it. Our first segment is something we like to call Eon Flux.
This is a journey.
I'm gonna make a movie.
We have to go back, Kate.
Wow, how did you know all that stuff?
I did my research.
I don't understand any of this.
What the fuck is going on?
We are going to scour through the history of Eon Productions and give you all the highs and lows that went into the makings of these films. The film we are talking about today, of course, Quantum of Solace. And I will say it slowly because I'm afraid I'm going to say solace every time I say it. So. We'll see what happens. This is the 22nd film in the official James Bond franchise. We really are getting very close to the end here. We've only got three more after this until, of course, they start making new Bond films with probably no one we've ever heard of mm-hmm. by the time they actually announce it. It'll be like, you know, Jake Spivey from that episode.
Jake Spivey, absolutely.
Boy Meets World.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
Yeah, it's definitely going to be that.
Out of all the shows I could have picked, I went with Boy Meets World.
Mm-hmm. Hey, there was somebody who was suave and debonair on Boy Meets World that we didn't know about. That's just the way it is. You have to start somewhere.
That's true. So this premiered at the Odeon Leicester Square on October 29th, 2008. And then it got its UK release just 2 days later on Halloween 2008.
Hmm.
Happy Halloween. I wonder if a bunch of people came dressed as Bond.
Oh, I bet they did.
And it was released in the U.S. a couple weeks later on November 14th. So this is the first one in a while where the U.K. got it a few. And I think this ends up being pretty consistent with the next few. I could be wrong, but that sounds, I feel like.
Yeah, I think so.
Like, they always had stuff on Twitter before we did. Like, they were people had seen it. The budget is between 202 to 230 million. So this is even more than Casino Royale. But it made a little less, but it still made $589 million worldwide. So it definitely wasn't a hit for sure.
Mm-hmm.
$168 million was the U.S. Canada. It had the largest opening weekend for a Bond film in the U.S. It was $67.5 million. It tied with The Incredibles. This is like the weirdest way to write a stat, by the way, but I copied it exactly how it said because I thought it was weird. It tied with The Incredibles as the largest November opening weekend outside of Harry Potter movies.
Mm, okay.
Like, what? Like, why would you be that specific? And how many Harry Potter movies opened in November?
A lot.
Maybe the first couple?
A few.
I thought they went to summer.
One was in the summer for sure. But I believe they did Deathly Hallows maybe in November.
Oh, maybe they did. You might be right.
And then the summer was the second one. But yeah, they did come out with them in November a few times.
Okay.
I think. I'm pretty sure.
I just thought that was a really weird way to write that.
That is a weird way to write
that
stat.
Just don't think about Harry Potter.
Yeah.
It's tied with The Incredibles.
Yeah, yeah.
I also did realize The Incredibles came out in November. I figured that was a summer movie. But anyways, it finished ninth at the U.S. box office. It made less than Twilight, which kind of makes me sad. It made a little more than Horton Hears a Who. That was, of course, the year. This is 2008. So this is like superhero movies. Are you ready for some superhero movies? Because they're coming and they're here to stay. If you count Hancock, which I guess you should, it's not an adaptation, but it's still a superhero movie. Top three of the top four movies were superhero movies because you had Dark Knight, Iron Man, and then Hancock was fourth. The Indiana Jones film that we just decided doesn't exist. It somehow finished at number three, which is weird because it doesn't exist. It's not a movie, so
yeah.
I don't know how it made all that money.
Makes no sense, weird. Really, when it comes down to it.
And animated movies are still really ruling the box office. There were four. I already mentioned Horton Hears a Who, but also WALL-E. God, WALL-E and Kung Fu Panda came out the same year.
Yeah.
That's insane. And Madagascar 2. That was a big year for DreamWorks.
Yeah. Oh, and just looked it up, too. Harry Potter movies were November, and then they did go to summer, but then they'd go back to November, and then they had a couple of summer in a row, and then it went back to November, and it's kind of like back
there's like four. Probably like four of them are
there's
November.
Like four that come out in November,
So yeah, so just say it's the fifth highest grossing November.
Yeah, why not? Yeah, exactly. There's no shame in that. There's no shame.
Oh man. All right. So that's pretty much it for the release. We'll get into some more stuff later. But as far as the development of this, so we've got Neil Purvis and Robert Wade. We're going to be saying their names. Not quite as much as Richard Maybaum, but they're gonna stick with us.
And Paul Haggis coming back too.
Yeah, he's back. He's back, motherfucker.
That's right. Exactly.
He's crashing back in.
Exactly. Exactly. Terrible. He crashed into us. No, that's Dave Matthews. Sorry.
Dave Matthews, last band I saw at Starwood. A little history.
Interesting.
A little trivia for the three other people that know what Starwood is that are listening to
it. Exactly.
So prior to them even filming Casino Royale, Michael Wilson already has Purvis and Wade working on the next script. They purposely set up Casino Royale to where it would continue into, they were going to set up all this stuff. And then here we get the next thing. So they had already started working on their whatever they do for the script, their outline or whatever it is they do, before they bring Paul Haggis in apparently to rewrite it. That's a thing going on right now. So they wanted it to be all about him dealing with the loss of Vesper. And just about, conflicted about whether or not, she betrayed him, which is interesting because, I mean, M tells him what she did for him at the end of Casino Royale.
Yep.
So it's kind of confusing at Quantum of Solace. He's still like, I totally forget about that completely.
Well, his thing all the way through these movies is pretending like she doesn't matter to him. Like, yes. I'm cool and I'm awesome and, no girl that I like had an affair with one time, is going to prevent me from doing my job, even though that's what he keeps drives him all the way through this. So,
the original script was a little, or the original outline or whatever was a little different. Bond is releasing Mr. White, that's what happens at the beginning of this. So he can follow him and figure out what's going on. He's trying to find out what this organization is, which we're going to find out in this movie.
He doesn't release him. There's the they have him in custody. And then the secret guy shows we have people everywhere. Yeah, so happens to be there. So
everywhere.
Yes, exactly.
Why couldn't it have been Gary Oldman? Damn.
Right?
They messed up. That's right. So, but in this version, he does release them, and that's how he's going to track down this organization, which we find out at least this part of the organization is called Quantum. This gets a little retcon when they actually get the rights to Spectre back and all that stuff. So we'll get to that in a couple movies. But they're Quantum in this movie.
Yeah.
And they stay that way. I mean, it's kind of like Quantum's like a subsidiary company or something. It's
right.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Like this is like a
easy
like,
to retcon like a, like, when you're like, well, that was the name we thought you wanted. This is the name we wanted you to think we were called or whatever.
Yeah, so he releases Mr. White. This is the original thing. And then the villain, I didn't learn much about the villain. The villain's name in this was Dante. And he is aligned.
Dante's Inferno.
Yeah, well, that's fair. Yeah, that's why. He is aligned with Yusuf Kabira, which was, you know, Vesper's boyfriend. So there was the whole thing with all that. And then they decided, they ended up changing it. Paul Haggis comes in and they rewrite some stuff. Roger Mitchell. Tired to direct in 2006. He has directed Notting Hill is probably his biggest, maybe one of his biggest claims to fame. I think you love this movie too. We saw it together. This is actually the day I met Jeremy in person, right? It was Changing Lanes.
Yeah, yeah.
So Changing Lanes is very, it's got meaning.
It does. It's yeah, that was yeah, I remember that because we went to his theater that he was managing at the time.
But that's a cool movie that like nobody really talks about. I mean, I think over the years it's gotten a bit of a following, but it's still it's one of those I don't hear enough. I feel like I should hear more about it.
Mm-hmm. What I want is my time back. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like a early version of a road rage movie, which I don't remember what that Russell Crowe one was recently, but. Is better than that.
No idea.
It was like when COVID was like when theater started opening back up, it was like the first like, oh, now I got to look it up because now I got to figure out what it is. Literally just typed in Russell Crowe road rage movie. It's called Unhinged.
Unhinged.
I don't recommend it.
Don't know that one at all.
It's kind of like a mix of Changing Lanes and Falling Down. And it's not anywhere near as cool as that sounds.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, he's hired to direct it in 2006. They put the release date May 2nd of 2008, so like a year and a half after Casino Royale would have come out. He ended up stepping down later in 2006 because it was just the script was not progressing at all. And there's also a writer's strike on the horizon, which is causing some issues with everything. Paul Haggis is brought in to rewrite. Paul Haggis actually said he finished the script 2 hours before the strike started.
Wow.
But because the writers were on strike, though, they could not have writers doing any kind of rewrites or anything while they were filming. And so that actually ended up being Mark Forster, who ends up coming on to be the next director, and Daniel Craig. Daniel Craig has said, many times since then, I am not a writer.
Yeah,
he's like, it turned out about as well as it could. So they hire Mark Forster. Mark Forster was not the only person they were talking about, though, after Mitchell stepped down. Tony Scott's name got thrown out there again. Jonathan Mostow, I don't think I've heard him mentioned yet. So I think this is the first time I've seen his name mentioned. Jonathan Mostow, people might, I break down the Kurt Russell 90s. Yeah. Amazing fucking movie. Terminator 3, which I think's kind of good.
Yeah, it's underrated for sure.
Especially within the Terminator movies.
U571 was the movie that I think was it U571 that he did?
Yeah, he did U571, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't remember a thing about that movie. I know I saw it.
And then I'm trying to remember if there was another one in there, but he I love Breakdown. That
it's so good. Great. Well, and it's like and I almost like actually because of the way Quantum of Solace and I get why they probably wanted him and Tony Scott because of the way they decided to do the action in this movie. And I mean, Tony Scott might have been a little crazy. I don't know, but I don't know. We'll talk about that when we talk about the movie. I mean, Mark Forster is a perfectly fine director. He's a little middle of the road. He's a little Ron Howardy when it comes to, you know, he makes really good movies occasionally, but he also just makes a lot of like. Finding Neverlands and stuff like that. But perfectly fine. He was coming off an adaptation of The Kite Runner, which was a really popular novel. around this time. I have never seen that movie. But he also just recently done Stranger Than Fiction, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
I already mentioned Finding Neverland, and then Monsters Ball, of course, was the movie that kind of, you know, put him on the map. So we got Forrester in there. Forrester was really surprised they asked him. He is not a Bond. He said he wasn't a Bond fan. Really, he did like dislike it, but he just, it wasn't his thing. But he loved Casino Royale.
Yeah.
He loved the way they, he said that he felt they made Bond more human.
Mm-hmm.
I still think it's funny watching these so close together. I still think it's funny when people keep talking about the more realistic one. I know I've said that a bunch, but it always makes me laugh because it's like, these are not realistic movies in any way, shape, or form.
They aren't, but there's something about the performances and and the way, you know, the way everybody emotes and acts and things like that.
Yes,
that,
it's more stripped down too. It's not as like broad and
and you know, and the action scenes back in the 60s and so on. I remember, you know, watching the making of on like Dr. No and Thunderball and all these, and they were like talking about how proud they were of those fight scenes. And I'm sure they were back in the 60s, but they are not very good when you watch them today.
No.
I'm sure for the time they were fine, but you know, it's, you know, now I mean, of course now the problem is that they have to edit them to death, but there is a little
bit. They don't have to, they do.
That's the main problem with them today is that the editing makes them bad, but not the actual physical, like, you know, the stunt the stunt work is actually pretty good. It's just that the editing in the editing room, for whatever reason, they think it's just way more exciting if you keep cutting and cutting and cutting. So,
and I will say, I mean, I don't know that Mosdow and Scott would have been different, but I will say with Forrester, like, he basically refused to use green screen. So, like, there's a lot of, like, and I mean, there's not really a whole lot of stuff, but, like, that free fall scene, you know, they used, like, I'll get to that in a minute.
I was actually kind of wondering how they did that. And again,
like an air tunnel.
Oh, yeah. Okay, again, this is another one of the later Bonds that don't have a making of on it, so...
I'll hold off on that since we'll get to it shortly. Tony Scott and Mosdow were considered. Forrester got the job. He also was the first director of a Bond film to not come from the British Commonwealth of Nations. Thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
He's also the reason the movie is short. The one thing he didn't like about Casino Royale, one thing we talked about Casino Royale was the runtime.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted this one to be tight and fast like a bullet. The way he phrased it.
That's funny that he wanted it to be that way, but he doesn't really have much of a say in this thing. So I don't understand why Mark Forster comes in and says, I want a shorter Bond, and Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson are like, yeah, sure, why not?
Who knows? He could be taking credit. I mean, directors will take credit for stuff that's not really theirs. So, I mean, Tarantino tried to say he was the reason they filmed Casino Royale.
That's true. That's true. Mm-hmm.
But he, at least maybe he was happy it was going to be short. I don't know. He really wanted it to be shorter. Yeah. And it kind of makes sense within the context of what they're trying to do. Like, this isn't really this doesn't have a huge elaborate, well, it kind of does actually have a huge elaborate plot, but the way it's presented, it's a little, like I said, stripped down, I guess is the best way to say it. The original script's climax took place in the Swiss Alps, but Forrester requested that the action scenes, in his mind, the action scenes were like based around the four classical elements, earth, water, air, and fire, which I see that.
Okay.
The title does come from a short story that Ian Fleming wrote, but it only carries over like some thematic elements. There's this whole thing about when the quantum of solace drops to zero, humanity and consideration of one human for another is gone. Which just kind of fits in with the themes of the movie, but they didn't actually take anything from the short story.
No,
we've mentioned Quantum of Solace. I can't remember what movie, but things have been taken from it from other films. So we have mentioned it in the past. They also decided to make the name of the organization Quantum, which we already kind of mentioned. Even though eventually they're going to get Spectre back, and so they're going to explain all that in a couple movies. I don't remember exactly how that gets explained, but We'll be talking about it. I already mentioned this. Due to the writer's strike, they couldn't get anyone in for rewrites, and so Forrester and Craig were handling all that. So Craig actually kind of, it's almost like a Kevin Smith Mallrats thing. I feel like Craig kind of takes some blame for this one. He's like, I'm sorry. Which he shouldn't. I mean, it's not his fault. He didn't have anything to do with it. He did his best he could, I'm sure, with the writing. Daniel Craig is back for his second appearance. He said this one was much more physically demanding, which I could see that.
Yeah.
Than Casino Royale. He got injured quite a bit. He got kicked in the face.
Huh.
He had a gash. They had to put 8 stitches in. And then he actually got plastic surgery, like a minor plastic surgery to fix it. He also cut off one of his fingertips, which sounds awesome. He didn't really care, though. He says, like, people asked him about that a lot. And he's like, man, it was nothing. Because there was a stunt man that had to be in intensive care. And at one point there were journalists were trying to say there was a curse on the set, maybe because there were all these accidents.
Hmm.
And Craig got really irritated because he's like, all I did was cut the tip of my finger off. Like, that guy had to go to intensive care. Like, it's not the same thing.
Right.
Like, you can't compare us. You know, he felt bad for the stuntman.
Yeah.
A stuntman. Stuntman. Like, it's a Jim Stuntman.
Yes.
He's a good guy. Makes a good brisk.
And he does.
We got Olga. Yeah. Kirilenko.
Yeah, I think that's about right. Yeah. Olga Kirilenko, who I think I had seen in Hitman, maybe. That was before this.
Yeah, she's definitely in Hitman. That might have been what I saw then. But she's in Oblivion.
Yes.
With Tom Cruise and Hitman. Yeah, Hitman was the year before. So I'm pretty sure that was probably.
I think that's where I had seen her first. And then,
she's in Black Widow. She plays Taskmaster in Black Widow. So she is Camille Montez. She's a former Bolivian agent. Well, I mean, they kind of throw that in at one point. Like, you were a former agent, right? She has a. This is like the most generic. Like, this is like the fifth or sixth time at least this has been done, where she has a vendetta against one of the guys that they're going after.
And
exactly. So her and Bond kind of end up getting in the same mission, even though, you know, but that, like, Spy Who Loved Me and
one of the early ones does this, where the sister gets killed or something. I can't remember what. Oh, well, that was Dr. No, wasn't it? It was Dr. No.
Oh, yeah. That was Dr. No. I think so. And then View to a Kill's kind of got that same type of situation. So it's just real generic. General Medrano is the one that, well, I'll get into him in a second, actually. So you got Olga Kirilenko. You got Matthew Almmerich as Dominic Green. He's the main villain. He has, like, the craziest, like, he looks like a Bond villain. Like,
yeah, he does. He's got those eyes.
Well, yeah, and he even said that he wanted to add makeup and stuff, and then Forrester was like, no, man, we're good. Like, you fit the part.
This guy has been in a lot of things, and I hesitate to, like, name them, because he's just been in so many. Was he in Munich?
Yeah, he was in Munich with Craig. I think that was the other thing I had seen him in. He's in Marie Antoinette, but I don't remember him in that. So
I don't either.
I remember him in Munich.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the only thing I had seen him in at that time. But yeah, he's done
at that time. Yeah.
So he's Dominic Green. That's the main villain. Almmerich said he felt like he had to take the role just because he didn't want to have a story, like, later in his life to his kids. Like, yeah, I was offered a Bond movie, but I didn't do it. So he was like, he felt like he should probably just do it. I already said that he wanted to wear makeup for the role, but Forrester was like, no, man, we don't need any makeup. You're fine. Almmerich said his performance was based around the smile of Tony Blair, who was the prime minister who stopped being the prime minister, like, the year before this came out, 2007. And the craziness of Sarkozy, the French president at the time, who I think ran until, like, 2012, I think. We've got Giancarlo Giannini. He is back as René Mathis. He was mistakenly believed to be a traitor in Casino Royale. And so now he's like the government, like bottom of house. And like, I can't remember where he is. Like, I can't remember where the location is, but yeah, he's living his life. He's got a girlfriend and he's hanging out by the beach all day.
Yeah.
And
she's like, want your hands on my body and things like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he's like, and then he's like, no, I'm going to go with this guy who fucking dicked me over.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Like,
killed.
Right. Yeah.
You think, you have to think, like, in that last, like, before his eyes, before he's just completely gone, he's like, man, I should have gone for the
did the rub down. In Mathis also ends up being exactly like everybody else who ever helps Bond in these movies.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No. I know that's not a secret, and I know that's the formula and everything, but it kills me that they went through all this trouble to be like, oh, he wasn't really a bad guy, and then they like bring him back for this next movie, and then, you know, and then all right, now we're gonna kill him.
Bond is like responsible. Like, he's been responsible for deaths before, but it really feels like in these, like, I mean, it's like his fault every time somebody gets killed.
And plus,
kind of crazy.
How is he a trained agent and not see that guy in the back seat of the car? Come on, man.
All right. Gemma Arterton, who's been, I don't know that I knew who she was. You mentioned something she was in before this.
Yeah,
so I don't remember.
I'm gonna look
this
up because I'm pretty sure I'd seen her in something just before this, but maybe this was the thing that I first saw her in.
Yeah. I remember, the first time I was like, oh, I kind of like her, which is weird. Cause it's actually not a bad movie, although it sounds like it is, but Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters. She's Jeremy Renner's sister or whatever. In that movie, they're like the witch hunters.
Mm-hmm.
And that movie, it's not a great movie, but it's so much better than you would ever think it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
She was really good in that. So I started paying attention to her, I think, after that, but she's done a lot of like smaller stuff, like Disappearance of Alice Creed. And, she was in that murder mystery movie with Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston. But yeah, she's around. She plays a character named Strawberry Fields, although they never actually say her first name, and I'm kind of glad.
She just says Fields. So I'm looking at her filmography and I did not see anything before this. She was in Rock and Rolla, but I had not seen Rock and Roller at this point. So
I had, but I wouldn't have remembered her probably. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure she has a big role in it, but I'm just saying I didn't remember much about it.
Yeah. So. And there's a whole bunch of movies around this time that I watched that she was in, but nothing before.
Yeah. So she pops up. She was one of reportedly 1,500 people that they had as candidates. I don't know if that's an actual number, but one of the casting directors had seen her in a performance of Love's Labor's Lost at the Globe Theater. Mm-hmm. Thought she was really good. Gemma Arterton really liked this role. She compared her character. She took inspiration from Diana Rigg from Honor Majesty's Secret Service and Honor Blackman from Goldfinger.
Mm-hmm.
The name was a reference to the Beatles song Strawberry Fields Forever, but like I said, they never even say her first name, and that was something I kind of got the impression Arterton actually asked them if they could just not do it. She felt it was better if they just left that alone.
Mm-hmm.
She even in 2018 she wrote a short story called Woke Woman, and it was based on this character. So it's something she keeps going back to, which I thought was kind of cool. She also gets to have the speaking of Goldfinger, she gets to have the homage to that where they replace is it Shirley Eaton?
Yeah, Shirley Eaton.
So she was covered in gold and Goldfinger, and the Gemma Arterton character, she is covered in oil.
They got the exact pose and everything.
Yeah.
The only difference with this one is I think they actually show, well, I don't know. They may have showed the exact angle in Goldfinger. It feels like there's a little bit more of her backside visible in this.
Does.
Like they couldn't do that in the 60s, but even though the 60s was pretty close. I mean, the angle of how she's lying down on the bed is exact same and everything. So,
oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the oil thing was supposed, cause that was kind of something in this movie that like oil is the new gold. Because there's even a part where, you know, he's like, if oil is what you want, and then the general's like, well, unless you found some diamonds or something like that, he said, it's all about how oil is like what people are concerned about now. Mm-hmm. Just a few more I'll mention. Anatole Taubman, he plays Elvis, which I mean, I thought that was fun that they gave him that name, but he's like Green's like second in command. And I honestly couldn't tell you one thing he does in the movie, but
not really. Actually for a longest time, I was like, is that Vesper's boyfriend right there? Because they just show him and he doesn't really do much. And then, yeah, of course, I mean, they do show the real guy at the end, but like they show him from a distance and I was like, oh, is that that guy? But yeah, whatever. Yeah. I don't know what he does either.
David Harbour, maybe like the biggest surprise cast member this entire franchise for me.
Mm-hmm.
He plays Greg Beam. He's the CIA section chief in South Africa. I'm not sure if he's Felix Leiter's boss, but I get the impression he's above Felix in some form or fashion. Because Jeffrey Wright is back as Felix Leiter.
Yeah.
And they have a couple scenes together, but it was just interesting to see David Harbour. Of course, if people don't know who that is, Stranger Things, most recent Hellboy, which he's awesome in, but that movie's not good.
Mm-hmm.
Violent Night. Where he plays a cursing, smoking, drinking Santa.
Yes.
Bad Santa, if it was the real Santa Claus.
Right.
So yeah, it was cool to see him, and he's like just such a weasel too. It was really funny.
Mm-hmm.
Rory Kinnear is back as Tanner. I think I just like saying Tanner. I feel like I bring him up on, but Rory Kinnear's here as Tanner. He'll be a little bit
more to do in this one than the last one. And he'll become more and more prominent as it goes along. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, I think in No Time to Die, we even made a joke about like they like felt like they had to wrap up the Tanner storyline.
Yeah.
He gets a little more to do. I like Rory Kinnear a lot, though. He's great. I'm not making fun of him. I've seen him give birth to a baby, so that's fun.
That's true. We all have. If you've seen Men, it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah.
Oh, spoiler for Men. Well, it'll be like 20 weeks from now, so it'll be Joaquin Cosio plays General Medrano. He's just like the sleazy general that the Dominic is trying to get stuff from and all that kind of stuff.
I understand that this type of of course we're going to have bad guys like this in the real world and everything. I'm not whatever, but it's just, that's something we didn't need in this movie.
I want to talk about that.
It's just one of those things they don't have to depict this unless there's a really good reason, and there was no good reason to do that in this one.
Dame Judi Dench. I feel bad. I don't think we've said Dame yet, which maybe we have. I don't know. Dame Judi Dench. I'm giving you respect today.
Right.
She's back for the sixth time as them. We only get to see her one more time after this. Mm-hmm. So. I hope you enjoy it. And then what I'll point out, she was just at the very end, but this was another like, whoa. And I don't know if you know this, cause I don't know if you've seen her in anything else, but I watched Castle, Nathan Fillion.
Yeah.
You know, Stana Katic, who played like the main FBI, the main police officer in Castle that Richard Castle was basing all his novels on.
Mm-hmm.
But she shows up at the end for like one scene with, I think she's with the boyfriend.
She's with the boyfriend. She's on some mission that Bond correctly guesses. She's like a Canadian secret service, whatever the hell they're calling it.
I don't think she pops up again, but I thought that was interesting.
I don't think so either.
I know. How do I know this person? And she looks like a kid. I mean, she's so young.
Yeah.
Cause I guess Castle was probably still like 3 or 4 years from happening.
Mm-hmm.
Filming took place in several countries, Italy, Spain, the U.S., which I thought was funny. The U.S. specifically Baja California, which immediately made me think of Diamonds Are Forever. I don't have anything in Baja. They also filmed in Mexico, Panama, Chile, and the U.K., of course. Chile, the local mayor, this guy named Carlos Lopez, he actually staged a protest. He was against because Chile and Bolivia, especially at this time, did not have great relations,
mm-hmm.
and they were using the Antofagasta region in Chile. They were pretending that was Bolivia,
mm-hmm.
and that pissed him off.
Mm.
But then he actually got arrested for raising the protest because everybody else was like, shut up, man. We want people to come film here. Like, that's money we can make.
Mm-hmm.
And but then Eon Productions, when they were questioned about it, they said they were not aware of that if it happened.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows? But that was the story I read. That was interesting. Bolivia was used in the movie also because that country actually has a lot of issues with water.
Yeah.
When they were shooting on the rooftops, those were actual rooftops. I thought was interesting because they realized it was cheaper than building sets in Pinewood.
Okay.
I don't have a lot of details on a lot of this, but just a few things. The car chase that took 4 weeks to film, which seems crazy, but I mean, I guess it's pretty in depth. I don't know.
Yeah.
In the original script, Mr. White was actually killed, but then they decided they might want to bring him back, which they do. I think he's Inspector. So they ended up getting rid of that. I already mentioned there were some accidents on the set. There was an Aston Martin employee that had to drive one of the Aston Martins to set, and he crashed it in the lake.
Huh.
And he was fine, but he got fined for reckless driving.
Huh.
And that stuntman I was talking about, his name is Aris Komnenos. He's a Greek stuntman. He had to be put in intensive care. I couldn't find out what exactly happened, but in one of the stunts, he just got hurt really bad. Hmm. There was a couple other stuntmen that got hurt too. And that's when the rumors came up that there was a curse. And that's when Daniel Craig got like his, got pissed off.
Yeah.
The scene at the opera house in Austria, which is cool. It's like a floating stage. Like I was like, I don't care about opera, but I want to go see something there. That required 1,500 extras. The play they're performing is Tosca.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I mention that is because I don't know if you remember this, but like back when we were younger at the Carmike theaters, I don't know when this was, late 80s, early 90s, maybe, those ads that would come up on the screen, and there was one that would pop up for Tosca. Like, you know, like where advertisers would put like just the still ads.
Yeah.
And I just remember it said like, it was like, a man, a woman, a death, Tosca,
yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah, those were those slide projectors that they used to put
yeah,
in.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. God, I remember coming in on Wednesday nights and I think it was like once a month, there was this woman who came in with her son or whatever and went around to each carousel putting in new slides and taking out the old ones and all of that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
It's cool. I didn't know that. That's how it happened.
Oh, yeah.
Peter Lamont, the production designer who we've talked about.
Yeah, he's been around for quite some time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he retired after Casino Royale.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy, Dennis Gassner, was hired. He had done work on The Truman Show and some Coen Brothers films. Mm. And so Forrester liked him, liked his work in those. And they said the idea, though, that they tried to do is they wanted to keep the classiness of the Adams sets, but they wanted to make them a little more contemporary.
Mm-hmm.
He also redesigned the MI6 headquarters because he thought Judi Dench would appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that means.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
he said the MI6 headquarters set, he said he thought Judi Dench in the previous film looked sad.
Oh, okay. Okay.
The gun barrel sequence was actually done at the end of the film.
Yeah.
As opposed to the beginning. So I thought that was interesting. MK12 was the company that designed the opening titles. They had worked with Forster on Stranger Than Fiction and The Kite Runner.
Mm.
It's really weird because I just watched this yesterday, but like I don't even really remember the opening credits.
Yeah, I mean the opening credits are a lot like Casino Royale's, only there is a slight return to having silhouetted women. Yes. In it and everything. So I mean it's kind of a hybrid of the classic ones and Casino Royale.
This is going to be the biggest shocker for you. Dan Bradley came in. He was brought in as a second unit director. His previous two films were the last two Bourne movies.
Yeah, not as a shock at all. Yeah, it's obvious, you know, like Casino Royale has a little bit of that influence with the parkour scenes and all of that. But then this movie for sure has a lot of Bourne in it.
That could be Jason Bourne. That could absolutely just be Jason Bourne.
Yeah.
He's you know, getting revenge on the people that killed.
Yeah.
Run Lola Run.
Yeah, exactly. Who killed Run Lola Run? Absolutely. Yes. The thing that
I feel bad. Her name escapes me.
Well, it's Franca Potenta. Franca
that's
Potenta.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
It'd be really funny that he's trying to find the person who killed Run Lola Run, because famously in that movie she kept getting lives to come back to life or whatever.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
But I do know what you mean. It's Franca Potenta just coming in and, you know, whatever. She's not really playing Run Lola Run. That's how we're describing it.
For the plane sequences, they built this thing called a snakehead camera. They placed it on the nose and the tail. It was this plane. It's called a Piper Aerostar 700 for plane people. The camera could turn 360 degrees, and it was shaped like a periscope. They said that the plane sequence was an homage to North by Northwest. And the opera scene was actually an homage to The Man Who Knew Too Much.
How's the plane scene a North by Northwest homage?
I don't know. I'm just quoting what Forrester said, but I couldn't figure that out either. But
there's no dog fighting in North by Northwest.
And it's not like it's a crop duster. I don't know. I thought
Cary Grant is running from a plane in North by Northwest, but he is not in a plane.
Well, and I don't even think, is there an opera in The Man Who Knew Too Much? Like, I don't know. I know she's a performer, but
I haven't seen that in forever.
Doris Day, you know, she's a performer, but I don't know. The free fall scene. Okay, so they shot this in an air tunnel because Forrester really didn't want to use a green screen. They could only shoot for 30 seconds at a time. And Craig and Kirilenko, they had to wear these special contacts so they could actually open their eyes.
Okay.
But they just kept filming it in segments. And then, you know, it's a really cool effect, however they did it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how they survive, or at least I don't know how Bond survives.
Well, yes. In real life, there's no fucking way they would survive this.
She's on top of him. So, I mean, they would at least be very injured.
They open the chute 20 feet above the ground. That they're dead. Sorry to say, they're dead. There was a similar one in Hobbs and Shaw, I think. They did the same thing. They did the same thing in Hobbs and Shaw, I think, where it was like, what the fuck, guys? What is they do in a lot of movies, but those two are particularly memorable for whatever reason.
Oh, yeah, where people fall. There's actually, oddly enough, even though, I mean, this is going to date us a little bit, but there's a falling scene and, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 that's kind of ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
It's very, yeah. But, yeah, so that's how they shot that. The only other thing I'll mention, the product placement, again, was kept to a minimum. I mean, minimum compared to Die Another Day.
Right.
It was still a lot. But Coke, apparently, I don't remember this, but Coke did, a limited run with their Coke Zero. It was called Coke 007.
Oh, okay. I don't remember that either.
But it actually makes sense that Coke is a thing, because there's a party that Dominic Green is throwing. People are drinking Coke.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so weird.
That is funny.
It's like, who goes to one of these, like people are in these expensive gowns and shit, and they're just drinking
Coke. Yeah, just drinking Coke. Yeah.
It's like that scene in, was it Kingsman, where Samuel Jackson brings out all the McDonald's.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, and it's not like we had a president in real life who did that McDonald's thing.
Nope,
that never happened.
Not at all.
Did you have anything on the production? Like, did you see anything?
I didn't see anything.
You wanted to bring up?
The special features on Quantum of Solace were all location shoot stuff.
Yeah,
and
I didn't bother.
I didn't bother clicking on any of them. So, because that's just going to be a bunch of people getting interviewed before they get into a scene or after they've done a scene.
And
not really going to tell you anything juicy. Yeah,
we're so excited.
So, yeah, that's a weird thing. I don't think I'll ever understand this 50-year anniversary box set, the way they put it together, because for all the way up into, I think even to Casino Royale, they had the exact same menus. They didn't do any, and like I said, the Brosnans and Casino Royale don't have any real making ofs on there, mm-hmm. like they did with all the other discs. But Quantum of Solace, the disc that is in the 50-year anniversary, is like if you bought the single one, because there's trailers yeah. on it and all this. I mean, I was like, why did you make this 50-year anniversary like this, where it's like Quantum of Solace is just kind of like, oh, we still have some discs in the back. Let's put that in there.
It's probably what they did. Yeah. They wanted to forget this would happen. They're mm-hmm. just like, no.
Right.
Quantum of exactly. what? Did we yeah. make that?
I'm imagine sure Skyfall is going to be the guy. Same way. I imagine Skyfall is going to be the same way, though. Probably. Skyfall will be the last that I watch in the 50-year anniversary edition. And I have a feeling it'll be trailers and all sorts of stuff, too. So,
yeah, maybe. I mean, well, that also, I think, has to do with the fact, because I think what they normally do with those box sets a lot of the time, especially with like the main studios, the boutique labels, you know, Shout Factory and stuff like that, they'll do some new stuff. But I think a lot of the times those boxes, they just take the original release and then they just put it in a box. I don't think yeah. they. So by the time we get to Quantum of Solace, I don't know. I mean, there's still a lot of DVDs and Blu-ray. I mean, Blu-ray's just becoming a thing at this point. So mm-hmm. it's not like physical media is slowing down at that point.
Yeah.
But they did stop doing as many special editions and stuff, unless it's like a boutique label.
Yeah.
And some of the studios have gotten back into it, like Paramount's doing those like Paramount Classics mm-hmm. line where they have numbers on them and stuff, which I hate when they do numbers. I hate this with Criterion Collection too, because then it's like I've got 10, 17, and 23 or something.
Yeah.
Oh, it pisses me off.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, I know. I'm not buying fucking like Curly Sue or whatever just so right. I can have
exactly. my numbers.
I have no idea if Paramount made Curly Sue. They probably didn't, but that was just the name of the movie right. that popped in my head. I don't want to own Curly Sue is what I'm saying.
Yes.
Fuck that movie.
Right. Fuck it. Right. If there's anything that you need to get out of this podcast at the end of the day is that fuck Curly Sue.
So music, David Arnold's back. This is his fifth score. Forrester actually gave Arnold a lot more time to do this. Forrester apparently is really into working with composers, and he wants to get that going immediately so they can, you know, have some time with it. So he was really appreciative of that. One thing I definitely didn't remember, I mentioned this to you yesterday, and you're like, I didn't either. Jack White and Alicia Keys.
Yeah.
Seeing Another Way to Die. That's the theme mm-hmm. song for this one. It was recorded in Nashville, Tennessee.
Where I live close to. Yeah, I can't remember if Jack White had moved to Nashville by this point.
Might have. Because he's got like a restaurant or a club or something, right?
Well, yeah, he's Third Man Records is out here too.
That's what I'm thinking of. Yes,
but I don't remember him coming out this early, but maybe he did. It feels like I don't know. It may be this early because I remember working at Hollywood 27, and I remember him coming out about an auditorium being too loud. I was like, Jack White's telling me an auditorium's too loud. And I went up
to go to your next concert.
Exactly. I demand you to lower the volume, sir.
Do you remember me?
But yeah, exactly. But I do remember that. So that was the last time I worked at Hollywood 27 was 2013. So he could have been here.
Yeah.
Around
or he had a place
time.
Here and he was going back and forth. And it's not, I mean, you know, a lot of things record in Nashville. So I guess it's not sure. really that odd. Because Alicia Keys doesn't live. I don't think she does. I mean,
no.
I'm not aware.
No.
But yeah, it's interesting because at first I thought maybe that's just the White Stripes, but then I couldn't remember if she ever really sang because I haven't listened to a ton of White Stripes. I hate to say, but I like them, but it's just for some reason I've never just, hey, I'm gonna listen to White Stripes album.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, it's Jack White and Alicia Keys. They sing Another Way to Die. It was recorded in Nashville. This group called the Memphis Horns are playing in the background on the song.
Mm-hmm.
Jack White was a huge fan of John Barry's instrumental work and on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of inspired the track, he said.
Mm-hmm.
Which that makes more sense than that plane scene.
Yeah.
Being yes. North by Northwest.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Say you haven't seen the Hitchcock movie without saying you haven't seen
right.
Hitchcock.
Right. God, is it? I hear this all the time, though, right? This is just
That's why
an
I brought
aside.
It up.
Just as an aside. You hear bands sometimes, like a band will come out, like a Creed.
Oh, yeah.
a Creed or something. They'll be, and I'm not saying this is what Creed said, but like they'll say something like, yeah, our influences are Louis Armstrong and the Kinks and Sly and the Family Stone. And you're like, Creed? How the fuck do you have these influences? I don't hear any of that in your songs. Anyway.
Mark Ronson and Amy Winehouse, they recorded a demo track for this movie. I don't know if I didn't read if it was actually supposed to be the theme song originally, or if it was just going to be a second song.
Mm-hmm.
But that was around the time she had a lot of legal issues going on, and she wasn't up for doing anything beyond the demo track. So it never happened. Mm-hmm. I can't remember when she died, but it wasn't super long after this, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't think it was.
I mean, she was really young. So,
oh yeah.
But yeah, one of my wife's favorite singers. One of the, like, that's the one she's sad she never got to see her.
2011.
Yeah, so like 3 years after this, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Reception. Reviews were also much like Ron Howard. They were very middle of the road.
Yeah.
I feel bad. There's like five or six Ron Howard movies I love.
Yeah. But it seems like a bulk of his filmography is like, oh, yeah, that's all right.
A lot of it's Ed TV.
Yeah.
There's a little more Ed TV than there is Apollo 13.
Exactly. So,
but no, he's made some amazing movies. But the action and the emotional stakes of the movie were praised. But the main thing it seemed to be, this wasn't as good as Casino Royale.
Yeah.
The Sunday Times was one that they really laid into it. They called the casting a mess. They said the screenplay was at times incomprehensible, which is probably fair. And there was probably a reason for that. And then the review goes on to mention that the gritty realism the movie tries to go for just comes off phony. That's what they said.
Hmm.
The title also gets mentioned a lot. Like, people complain about the title, which is, I don't know.
Yeah.
Although Marnie Wise, who's the editor of Famous, stated that while the title was bad, at least it wasn't Octopussy.
Yeah, there is that.
Everybody loved Craig still, though. He was getting a lot of praise. Lowest cinema score audience rating for a Craig film. It got a B-. I don't really understand what that is, even. I feel like that's one of those things, like when you go get your car done and they'll be like, hey, we're going to send you a survey. If you give us anything less than 10 out of 10, that's considered unacceptable. I feel like it's probably something like that.
I don't know. I've never participated in a cinema score before.
Either.
I don't know how they, I mean, I'm sure we could look it up, and I know that there are people listening who know how it's done, but I get the sense it's like a quick sample of audiences when they come out. Do they give it and you probably have to be a participating someone, like kind of like the Nielsen ratings or something used to be, but I mean, for the most part, these people coming out of the theater are giving the movie A's. I think you can always pretty reliably say that people are kind of being nice. That's why when it gets down to B- and C and stuff like that, you know, there's more F's than usual in the
The
opening weekend.
That makes sense.
So like whenever you see a cinema score that's B- or C, and there's been a few that have gotten to that D and maybe even F category. Can't remember.
There is some for F.
Like
yeah,
The Witch
like
may have been one of those that was like a D or something. Like there's been some
probably,
like movies that, like, critics really love, but
Mother was an F.
Mother was an F. Yeah.
And there was another one. What was that really good one? Oh, Killing Them Softly. I remember that was that.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
One.
Yeah. Killing Them Softly.
And there's like some that are terrible. Like, I think like Date Movie or Epic Movie, like a couple of those I think are F's. Because
I
randomly listened to a podcast that was talking about the ones that were an F. So that's how
something
I
where
song.
You can almost reliably believe that the movie is terrible when they.
No, that actually makes sense.
It's. I mean, I don't know. I mean. Sometimes audiences are like, you mentioned one that I don't think deserves an F. Mother is one. And I think The Witch, like I said, The Witch was one that was either a D or a C or something. I don't think it deserved that. So audiences are kind of fickle. It is kind of hard. But like, whenever you see like some average movie that comes out or some average blockbuster or whatever that comes out and it's got a B-, usually that's a pretty bad sign for it. Because it means more than a few people are not liking it. When it gets into the B+ and the A- category, then usually it has a decent amount of legs after that. So,
Yeah, I feel like it almost like I've even seen some people say if it's lower than A minus, it's you know, but I never thought about it that way. That makes sense because it's the average, right? So yeah, if it's getting a B minus or even a B, that means people are giving it D's and F's.
Basically, you're most of your people are giving it A's and A minuses or whatever. Then there's going to be a small amount of B's and a small amount of C's and an even smaller amount of D's and F's, and then it usually comes out to being B something.
And I don't know if this is CinemaScore, but over the last like year, there's been people at the theaters out by us. They'll have like pads when you walk out, and they'll hand you a pad.
Oh, might be.
And I don't do it normally because I'm an asshole. But yeah. My wife has an MBA in marketing. So she feels, you know, she's like, I know they're just trying to do their job. And so she always will. But I don't know. I've never asked her. I should ask her that next time, like what they ask her when she does that. Because she'll always help out marketers. Like whenever we're at Disney, they have those people walking around with the pads. I'm just like, oh, crap. I hope she doesn't see that person.
Yeah.
We're going to be standing here answering questions.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, I'm complaining about my really nice wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm the same way. I hate because getting stopped. I hate getting stopped for anything. I have to say, I remember watching a movie in New York. It was that Death of the President movie that came out.
Yeah.
And I came out and there was like somebody from like Swedish radio or something like that came up to me and asked me what I thought of the movie. And I gave her a response that really confused her. And then she moved on. So
but I have not seen anybody from a radio show. That would be a first.
Yeah.
I've not experienced that. That's awesome. So I think that's all we've got for Aeon Flux. That just kind of gives you some of the behind the scenes. So now we're going to go talk about what we thought about the movie. We've talked about that a little bit, but we're going to dig into it a little more in a segment we like to call A Review to a Kill.
I've got you in my sights.
Get the fuck out of my sight before I demolish you.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
There's no need to shout.
I'm not shouting.
Why don't you stop your whining and get on with it? I've heard this shit before.
We are going to give you our thoughts on whatever film we are discussing this week. This week we are discussing the stupidly titled Quantum of Solace, at least according to the Sunday Times.
Yep.
Before we get into this, I will say a synopsis. James Bond descends into mystery as he tries to stop a mysterious organization from eliminating a country's most valuable resource.
That valuable resource, as we find out, is water, and it becomes like the James Bond Chinatown, essentially.
And actually, I forgot to mention that Michael G. Wilson said that it was basically Chinatown, but like replace, you know, he's like, but you know, he, you know, the oil and all that stuff. So yeah.
So it's Chinatown basically. And there's this long complicated thing going on with how this guy tries to do it. And I'm already blanking on the villain's name.
Dominic Green.
Dominic Green has this is pretending to be an environmentalist basically or whatever, and the whole idea is that he's basically creating a desert or he's damming off water in a desert so that the government has to pay him back for the water at the end. He has to install his own government with the help of the CIA. That's where David Harbour and Jeffrey Wright are coming in on this one. The CIA are going to topple the current dictator and put in the new dictator so that the new dictator will pay them money for the water. I think it's kind of hilarious how Bond keeps killing everybody, before he gets a chance to question them. I don't know if the movie's saying he's killing them, but just because, or it's just because the situation calls and demands for them to die. Cause in each one, it seems like he goes in and he's immediately attacked and he has to kill the guy. And then he's but M is always like upset, you know, like, you know, why you kill that guy is our only lead. And it's like, well, I was hanging off of a off of a scaffolding and this guy was going to shoot me and I had to shoot him back. I mean, he never says that type of stuff.
He's like Danny Glover. She's like Danny Glover in Lethal Weapon, like shoot him in the leg.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's the thing is that, you know, he's bringing Mr. White back from the end of Casino Royale. And then, you know, Mr. White, this is the thing. There's so many things that I have is very hard to swallow. Mr. White is sitting there going, I can't believe you really don't know anything about us, do you? Doesn't know anything about this organization that they're calling Quantum right now, but we know we'll be Spectre later. I find that so hard to believe that there's not one intelligence agency anywhere in the world who has picked up on some weird shit that's going on in the world and they can't connect it to a bunch of people. Like, that blows my mind that they're even attempting to say that, oh, the government doesn't know about this secret organization. And like, even the guy that ends up like helping White or trying to help White he actually does help White to get out of the interrogation. He's somebody who's apparently like, he's like been M's bodyguard for years.
Yeah security.
And somehow is able, he is like compromised, and like nobody can figure it out, nobody could see anything in his background check about it. Like, I don't really understand that, especially since even in real secret organizations, people know who James Bond is, people know who all these other people are. There's no way you can network like this, have a huge network like this, without somebody blabbing to somebody else. There's no way that this happens. So that is a weird thing. The other thing about this movie to me that I don't like, and I know that we're doing this before we're even getting into, you know, the actual ratings, but James Bond really sort of stumbles into everything the plot is giving it. Like, he stumbles on this plot. He is sent to go find that guy. They find, okay, so the I guess Mitchell, the guy that's in the interrogation room, that's MI6 that turns on him. They found some money in his pocket and they're able to trace that money and they're able to say, oh, this guy has the same kind of money from the same serial numbers. We just found out that he landed here. We're going to go over there. And so Bond goes to question that guy. And just as he goes into that dude's room, there's a big fight. That's one of the biggest Bourne fights there is in the whole movie.
Is
in that apartment. And he comes downstairs and just so happens to go talk to the receptionist at the hotel and says, was there any messages for me? No, but hey, there's this suitcase that's important to the plot that you told us to keep here. You can have that back. And as soon as he gets the suitcase and walks out, here comes Olga Korolenko showing up and says, get in the car, you're late, blah, blah, blah. And he's supposed to be a geologist. And that's another part of the whole thing where like Green has a geologist on staff, basically, whatever. But this guy's supposed to be posing as a geologist and is supposed to kill her for some reason that we don't really even figure out. We just know that Green is pissed off at her for some reason and he wanted her dead. I don't know how the timing comes down on this. I know that the guy just arrived in this place. What was the place that they go to that when Bond goes over and kills the guy who's supposed to be the geologist? What's the place that they're in at that point? Haiti. They're in Haiti. The guy just arrives in Haiti and Bond, like, you know, probably a day later comes over and fights this guy in his apartment, goes downstairs, just happens to get to talk to the receptionist and all that stuff. That's one of the things that I was just like, oh,
that's
come on.
That's the assassin. He's not even, too, right?
Yeah, it's an assassin. He's and the guy is, I think, posing as a geologist, but, you know,
yes.
And then he's supposed, and then there's another part in this movie. This is the plane scene that is clearly North by Northwest homage. The plane scene, they get into that dogfight and they parachute out. We've talked about the parachuting scene. So they spend the night in this cavern, and then they accidentally find the water that's been dammed down there. It's like, how does he just find this shit randomly in this? I don't even remember if we send this in the Sims video, by the way, but, there's so many things he's just stumbling on, and he's not really doing any real investigation.
Yeah.
He's just running into the problem. So it's weird to me that they're trying to do a Chinatown and I like Matthew Amalric and everything, but I don't think this villain is very good.
It's nothing to do with him. He looks the part. It's just, he's a nothing. Like
I'm going to forget he was the villain in this movie 2 weeks from now. I'll forget completely that he's the villain. And there's that weird exchange too, where he says, where Bond tells the Olga Kor, who's Olga Korolenko playing? She's playing Camille. They're in the plane and he goes, I heard that you got close to Green by having sex with him or whatever. And she goes, well, does this offend you? And he goes, not in the slightest. And I was like, why did you fucking bring it up then? I don't understand why you even brought this up. And then, and it's funny because her character kind of mirrors Bond. She has a revenge plot of her own because her family was killed by this general guy. And yes, there's a scene where this guy is like about to rape her. And it's like, okay.
He's about to rape another woman too.
Yeah, he's going to rape the the person serving them tea or what. I don't remember what she's doing.
Yeah, so, yeah, he's like in a room and like his guards are in there with him. It's weird.
It's just completely unnecessary type stuff. I'm not a big fan of this. I think if they were going to go with the revenge plot and I don't know, there needs to be some more fleshing out here, it feels like to me. And there's just not enough fleshing out. And this finale where it's like they're in that like power station or whatever the hell it is. What are they in? They're like, and it's like they, you know, it's on fire for the most part of it and everything. I get so bored during that last part of it. It reminds me, I don't know why it reminds me of this. It reminds me of Mission Impossible 2 at the end for some reason. I don't know why. I don't know why it does, but,
masks, they're taking masks off constantly.
That's what it is. That's what it is. This is just one of those. It's a filler. It feels like a filler episode of James Bond is what it feels like.
Yeah. And that's why, like, I don't know, like you said, I don't know why Mark Forster would lie about wanting it to be short, but I feel like they didn't have much of a choice because, I mean, they had to rush the script at some point because the writer's strike was coming. I mean, if Haggis is finishing this 2 hours before, they were rushing this big time.
Yeah.
And it kind of feels like that. It kind of feels like it just does. It just, it's, yeah, like you said, it, this is where, and other franchises have these movies too now. This is why I don't really like these people going like, we're going to make, you know, 3 movies or we're going to make 5 movies. Cause you're always going to have one of these where it's just, I don't know that it's bad, but it's just like, it just, nothing happens. Like it's just, I don't know. And I don't feel like Bond's any closer to achieving his goal at the end of this movie then he, in fact, I felt he might have even been closer at the end of Casino Royale. I don't know.
Yeah. This would have been, I feel like this would have been a lot better if it went along the lines of what you were talking about. The script was beforehand where they let Mr. White go, where it would have been kind of nice after Mitchell or whatever. Yeah. The guy's name is Mitchell, right? After he does the stuff that lets Mr. White go, somebody finds him ducking somewhere and they follow him and they try to figure out who this organization is through that, instead of all of this random this like stumble on like being a geologist assassin thing that they do with this movie and stumble on a
profession.
Yeah, I know. Stumble on a bad guy that we're not going to remember very soon after this and all that. And so yeah, like I would have preferred a better spy movie where they are following Mr. White and there's some other sort of plot that they could still do some of this, I guess, but I don't know. There's something not fleshed out.
It doesn't feel like a Bond movie most of the time. It feels like a Jason Bourne. And it's not like Bond hasn't like copied trends. I mean, you know, they did blaxploitation and they did, you know, Space Race and I mean, but those still feel like Bond movies. Like this feels like a Jason Bourne movie. Or even like you're talking about TV, kind of feels like an episode of 24 or something. I remember the opening, it felt like that, just the way the opening was and the way it looked. I don't really like how this looks either. Like, I don't think it looks very good. It's kind of, I don't know. It's just kind of grimy. And it's funny, the general thing, but the attempted rape, because I remember the only other time I can even think of where they've done something like that similar was that guard. Oh, what's her name? I can't remember which movie it was. She's the one that's in Wicker Man.
It was Britt Ekland.
So yeah, there's that scene in The Man with the Golden Gun where the guard is like starting to like kind of fill her up or whatever. Even like they don't go all full attempted rape. But I think it's interesting how people talk about like how sleazy Bond is. And I mean, it can be, but there's still like certain areas like they've never gone before. And so when they do, like they do in this one, you're just like, what the fuck is this here for? Like, this feels like a canon movie from like 1987. Like, I'm expecting like Michael Dudikoff to like walk in there and start kicking his ass or something. Like,
there's also
so weird.
There's also was it License to Kill? Where the guy
that's pretty sleazy,
who plays the captain, starts leering at Talisa Soto and is about to do something until the captain comes in and says, "Hey, I saw a stingray out. You might want to take a look at that."
That's true. That did happen. This one got a little farther than it has in the past.
Yes.
There's even like a, I don't know. Anyways, it's such a terrible scene. And then that leads to, like you said, the finale, which is just dumb. Like I don't even get how they escape. Like, they blow up a wall that's like not far from them.
Yeah.
And there's still all this fire around them.
It's like, well, as long as there's a hole they can go through, I guess they can also go through the fire that's there.
Yeah. And I like the cast is fine. Like, I mean, Olga Kurylenko, she's fine. Gemma Arterton's fine. It's nice to see, you know, Giancarlo Giannini back and all this. I mean, nobody gives like a bad performance. It's just, there's just really nothing to the characters. I mean, the Olga Kurylenko, she feels like a mix of just previous, you know, female characters we've seen in these movies.
Mm-hmm.
Same with Gemma Arterton.
Yeah. There's definitely not a Vesper in this movie.
No. And that's not this, I mean, and maybe that is part of this movie's problem is that it follows Casino Royale, but I don't know, even something like, and I haven't seen Spectre since the theater, and I don't remember liking Spectre that much, but I feel like I'm probably going to enjoy it more than this, just because at least it does like some goofy stuff or, you know, some crazy, like over the top stuff. Like, this is just so stripped down, which, I mean, and you could do that. Like, you could absolutely, like, you know, look at something like Prey. I mean, that's a super stripped down, like Predator movie, you know. You can do stuff like that and it can work, but it absolutely doesn't work here. I wrote in my notes for some reason, when he flips the motorcycle, that's one of the dumbest things I've ever seen in my life.
Oh yeah.
Dominic Green, at one point, they just say he's buying large tracts of land.
No.
That made me think of, like, is it Monty Python?
Monty Python, yeah. Holy grail. He's got huge tracts of land.
But they actually say that. Like, somebody just says that seriously. Like, yeah, he's been buying up huge tracts of land.
Yeah.
It's just, like, started dying.
Yeah.
I almost wonder if that was actually supposed to be a reference
or something.
It wouldn't surprise me.
It might actually be.
I don't think I mentioned this either last week about M, because I know I wanted to. Like, so they got Judi Dench back. I love Judi Dench, Dame Judi Dench. She's great. But, like, I do find it odd, and not that the Bond films have ever cared that much about continuity, at least not until these Craig films. But, like, I don't understand how, like, if we're starting at the beginning, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me, like, why it's her, I guess.
What do you mean?
Well, just because, like, Brosnan was an older Bond.
Yeah, so. I mean, I think if we're going by the rule that they are, they're sort of rebooting they can just kind of do whatever they want with the characters.
True.
The thing that's always been a weird thread through all the Bond is that they'll refer to things that happened in previous movies.
Yeah.
And it won't be it's clearly not the same Bond. Like, so it's a weird, there's a weird continuity thing going on with those. And we have characters who Desmond Llewellyn's Q character has mm-hmm. interacted with all of the Bonds all the way through Brosnan. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's true. That's
so, you know, this is the weird thing that keeps happening with this thing. It doesn't really make sense that she's dealing with Bond in his early years and he's like, you know, mm-hmm. and I don't know that there's an age difference between, I don't know. I think it's just they liked Judi Dench being M, and that was how they were going to. That's how they explain it. Is just that she's here. Don't think too much about it. And look, as a CinemaSins person, I hate giving them that. I hate giving them that type of thing because it doesn't make sense whatsoever. But they have all these weird continuity things all the way through. The there's always been that theory that like James Bond is just a code name or whatever. So, mm-hmm. so like every successful Bond that comes in is named something else, but they call him James Bond, but they did that. They still referred to his marriage in the Timothy Dalton movies.
Oh yeah. Like every few movies they would make a comment about it. It was weird.
So I think there's just a weird fast and loose thing with continuity in all these movies.
Yeah. And they seem to make it a point that, well, the 007 can be passed on, I guess, because of, you know, No Time to Die.
Yeah. Lashana Lynch is 007.
Yeah. And then M, we know, isn't just a letter, because there's that scene in Casino Royale where he makes the comment he knows her first name. Mm-hmm. Although I guess her first name could just happen to start with an M.
Yeah.
You know, but anyways, it's like, I don't want anyone to think I don't like Dame Judi Dench. I love her. It's just something that always kind of sticks with me. It's just a confusing, I don't know.
Yeah.
But you're right. Q was in all those, so I don't know why that didn't bother me. But
yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know.
But, and I'm glad she is. And I think Skyfall is, but from what I remember, I mean, especially when you watch Skyfall, I'm pretty glad that they did bring her back, because I don't think Skyfall would work like it does without her.
Right.
So, and I also like I do like the way they, because even with Brosnan, we talked about this where she felt like a different character. In a couple of them,
mm-hmm.
Because there's like, you know, in GoldenEye, she's like, you know, I don't want to put up with your shit. I think you're misogynistic. I hate you. And then, and I think it's the next one, Tomorrow Never Dies, she's basically saying, go fuck Terry Hatcher.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Like, what's going on? Pump her for information.
And like, really excited about it too, even though in the first one, she was so against it. Yeah.
Yeah. You're a relic of the Cold War.
Right.
Anyways, so at least here she's a little more consistent, and I like that they've built up this like almost like mother son kind of.
Mm.
I don't know if that's quite what it is. I don't know. Maybe a cool aunt.
Yeah.
But like, she seems to care for him, even though she acts like she doesn't. Much like he seems to care a lot more about Vesper than he acts like he does. Mm. But anyways, I don't know that I have a ton to say about it, other than it's just a movie that it's not terrible. It's maybe not even all that bad, but I don't think it sticks with you day or two after you've watched it.
Like I said, I've seen this maybe three times now, and every time it's like, oh yeah, this happens. Oh yeah, I forgot. Yeah.
But it's just like, and I mean, some of the action scenes are fun. Like, I mean, that the free fall, even though it's ridiculous how it ends, that's a pretty well shot scene. I mean, Forster's not a bad director. I like the opera bit. I like how, not necessarily like not that they fight or anything, but I like how Bond's listening in and then he just starts talking to
him. Yeah.
I just like how that scene plays out. And that actually was a smart thing to do, because then I don't know how he knew everybody would just get up.
Yeah, that's one thing that's weird. But yeah, it's probably one of the better scenes in the movie, sure.
Yeah, but at least that felt like there was a reason. Because like, for instance, in Casino Royale, I don't even know if we talked about this, but one thing that bugged me in Casino Royale, because I think I forgot to mention this, is that even though they've got this cover, when he gets there, he immediately says he's Bond.
Yeah, yeah. I actually mentioned that in the...
Oh, you did? Okay, cool.
But it was a very brief moment because he plays it off like, oh, well, that they're not going to be worried. They already know I'm Bond or whatever, or there's something...
Which
that,
they did, but yeah.
But like, there's no reason to be that that loose with... Mm-hmm. Everything when you're up at the receptionist desk at a hotel, there's no reason for that
so weird.
At all. And that lends into the thing too that I was talking about with like, I don't know why they even need the accountant out there anyway. Like, it makes no sense.
It
seems like they always do that where they give Bond somebody that he doesn't need for some reason. Like, Gemma Arterton in this movie. Is just there to kind of like, she's supposed to bring him back or something. I don't remember what it was that she.
No, that's it. She was supposed to like basically detain him. And if he didn't hang out with her until they had to leave, she was going to have him arrested. But that's also maybe this. I don't know. Go on. Cause you might be about to say the same thing I was going to.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I forgot it. That scene irritated me too, though, where they find her with the oil and she's dead. And M starts giving him shit and says, you know, she's like a desk person. Like, she works behind a desk and does reports. And then it's like, well, why the fuck did you send her out in the field?
Yeah,
like,
send
if she's
somebody
not,
who's good who could
send
actually.
An agent.
Yeah, right. I don't get it. I really don't get it. Yes, you want to kill if you as a movie franchise want to kill somebody who's expendable so that they're, you know, they're, but it doesn't make sense that they wouldn't just send an agent. They've killed agents many times in these movies. So agents who are not 007, obviously, many, many times. And of course, Bond is always going after people who have killed agents before. So yeah. If not an agent, someone who's at least like doing the Jodie Foster thing in Silence of the Lambs, you know, somebody like that. This is like at least got some training there.
And this is also the one where M's like, you know, you're done. Like, you got to go back in. Because that was after he was accused of killing Giancarlo. And then he just, like, leaves. And then all of a sudden she's, like, telling Tanner, like, no, it's fine. He's on to something. I trust him.
Yeah, they've got he's got a capture or kill order on him. Yeah. Yes. And he runs into her and she's just like, oh, okay, whatever. No big deal. What's the point of even putting that order on?
It doesn't even know whether or not he's killed Mathis. Like,
right,
has
exactly.
No idea.
Has
she
no
probably
idea.
Believes he didn't, but she doesn't say, and he never even says I didn't do
it. Well, and considering here's the other thing. Here's the bottom line to that. Considering they've already said that Quantum/Spectre have people everywhere and that somebody she completely trusted was part of this organization, she's letting James Bond just fucking go. Come on now.
There's also the other thing I was thinking about, since it's so short, like, there's all these things I feel like things must have gotten cut out or they just didn't expand on them, because like the David Harbour character doesn't make a lot of sense. Like, I can't figure out if he's bad or if he's just like, they've decided to work with this guy because even though he's evil, he can help them do other things. And then at the end, it's like, oh, by the way, Felix got promoted and that dude got fired.
Well, and that that didn't make sense either.
What happened?
That didn't make sense either, because if the CIA is all about installing a new government in Bolivia, then he did exactly his job in that scenario.
Exactly. So well, I feel like there was something
Felix, we see that you have a moral conscience in all of this. You were promoted. I don't get that at all.
You smoke a cigar really cool. So.
Yeah, exactly.
But
yeah.
Because I feel like there had to have been some scene where like he took money from, you know, like he was actually in cahoots with Green.
Right.
As opposed to just trying to do what the government wanted to do.
Right.
I don't know. But like I said, that's a lot of the problem with this movie. There's scenes that just feel like they should be there and they're not. I appreciate it being shorter, don't get me wrong, but there was stuff that didn't need to be in there. Mm-hmm. And you could have put this other stuff in there so we actually understood what the fuck was going on half the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But anyways, let's do our rankings, because I don't think there's much more to talk about other than that. Like I said last week, we are cutting out the gadget. So if you've listened to us, you know, past episodes, that's just not something right now that's really a part of these. So we're just going to keep it out for now. So instead of five categories, we are going to rank this film in four different categories. Our scale will be based on something that Bond holds near and dear to his heart, as long as they are shaken and not stirred, and that would be martinis. So for each category, we will rank from one to five martinis, five being the best damn liquid that has ever passed your lips, and one being the well liquor you had to settle for or too drunk to care that night. The story, your overall feeling toward the movie, what would you give that out of five martini glasses?
Man, yeah, this is getting back into, you know, bad territory. Some of the, like, it's not Man with a Golden Gun bad, for sure.
No.
I can't remember I gave Man with a Golden Gun, but
it, I don't think you've given anything less than a two.
I don't think so either. The fact that I think the biggest thing about this movie is that it's so unmemorable in so many ways.
Yeah.
That's probably the biggest criticism I have of this. There's nothing that makes me feel like, oh, that was a great Bond adventure. So, I mean, I'm going to go 2.5 on this movie. It's always been my least favorite. It's always been my, Daniel Craig that I don't like. It's always been the one that I like the least, I guess, or I dislike it. I don't like it in any really capacity. To say that I like it the least saying implies that I really it at all. It's one that I really dislike. And so I would give this a 2.5. That's just the thing. It's just, there's nothing exciting about this movie.
Yeah, this is like For Your Eyes Only territory for me. Like, that's another one where I'm just like, I barely remember what happened in that movie, you know, and I never remember it. And this will be the same way with this one. So, yeah, no, I'm the same. The Bond, Craig's still really good in this. But like you said, and this isn't his fault necessarily, but he seems like he's a worse agent than he was in Casino Royale, as far as he just kind of pops it like the things. And that's not actually... And so that does affect the performance a little bit. I'm still going to give it like 3.5. I mean, I don't think he's come that far down, but like, it's still Daniel Craig, but it's one of my least favorite, like, Bond appearances, I guess, in a movie.
Yeah. There's not much investigation going on here. And that's the thing for me that I feel like, I think there should be like tangible leads, and God, the only tangible lead that he ends up really getting is from the dude who has the like weird computer graphic thing that we see at the beginning with all the money that they trace, and they just, oh, that guy just landed in Haiti and he goes to Haiti. And that's really the only, he just kind of stumbles on everything else though. There's just nothing, why would this guy, God, this is another thing. Why would this dude in Haiti leave a suitcase in the, at the hotel reception? Do that? And it just, accidentally himself into so many things in this movie. So yeah, I'm the same. I think Craig is great and that's what elevates it. But the Bond in this is too lucky for words, so I'm going to give it a 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and then our next one is the villain and the henchman. So we've got Dominic, we've got Elvis, I guess.
Yeah.
The general, Mr. White. I mean, it's just kind of a bunch of, you know.
Haven't gone under 2 on anything, I'm giving 1.5 to these villains.
They're bad. They're bad.
They're all milquetoast. And then you have the one general guy who's, you know, okay, his thing is that he rapes. Okay, awesome.
These are very bad villains. I'm going to 1.
Mm-hmm.
And then last but not least, or maybe, I don't know, the song, the theme, Jack White and Alicia Keys, the song is called Another Way to Die. This song is bonkers.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, everything sounds right, but there's just something I really don't like about it. I don't know if there's just too much going on in it. I'm going to give it a 2. I mean, there's something about it. Like, but it feels like it works, but then by the time it's over, you're just like, I didn't like that very much.
I really like the instrumentation on it. I like the guitars. Yeah. It starts off, vocals are okay, but I don't really like all of that. I like Jack White. I like White Stripes. I like Alicia Keys. It's one of those things where there's two musicians that I highly respect collaborating on a song that is very below average. It's not, I don't like it at all. So yeah, I'm going to say it's a 2.5. I'll give an extra half for the instrumentation that's in this movie.
The instrumentation's cool. Although it does have that White Stripes, you know, packed auditorium, kind of like packed, like, you know, you're at a sporting event. It's got the very White Stripes sound to it.
If you notice too, the song is produced by Jack White as well. It's not by the composer, which is what they have traditionally done in the past.
Exactly.
So there was like sort of a collaboration with the composer as well. In this case, there wasn't. It looks like Jack White had a lot of power on this one. And that could have gone either way. And in this case, it just didn't. It's not a memorable song. Again, just like the movie itself. And it's not very good. It's not very good.
No, it's not. It's crazy. Because like you're kind of going, yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, and then when it's over, you're like, that wasn't good.
Down, 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 down. And you're like, oh, this might be pretty cool. And then like, you know,
I don't think your voice is. I don't think their voices gel either.
No,
like they don't
at all.
They don't. It's like they're singing two different songs
at all. Yeah, exactly. That's correct.
All right. So that's it. We did it. We talked about Quantum of Solace.
We talked about a Bond movie.
I already
forgot
what happened.
Yeah. Huh? We talked about a Bond movie. Woohoo!
That I'm going to forget what the plot. I already am forgetting the plot.
Yes.
But anyway, also before we go, we have social media. You can reach us on Twitter. We are at GoldSpy007. You can also reach out to me directly on Twitter. I am at SamLoomis13. You can email us at golddiamonddeath007@gmail.com. And if you like this podcast and other things under the CinemaSins brand, we also have a Patreon you can join at patreon.com/CinemaSins. And if you have a second to leave us a 5-star review at your podcast listening app of choice, we would appreciate it. I think next week's going to be a little more chipper from what I remember. So thank you for joining us this week. We hope you'll join us again next week. We will be talking about Skyfall, which I'm pretty sure becomes the next biggest Bond movie ever since Casino Royale. Until then, keep those martinis dry and shaken, the Baccarat shoe moving, and the Aston Martin fully gassed. This is Chris Atkinson and Jonathan Watkins signing off, and we will see you next mission. We'll be right back.